Front, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. In the worlds of city planning and urbanism, suburb is almost a dirty word. It conjures up thoughts of bland architecture, chain stores, car dependence, white middle class conformism.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky tacky.
Malvina Reynolds wrote this song in 1962, when a lot of big cities were shrinking as people moved to the suburbs. She was describing Daly City, just south of San Francisco.
And they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
But that image of suburbia doesn't quite do justice to the reality. Our next guest has been piecing together a very different story of the suburbs as a place that is diverse, a terrain that is contested, and as a place that is often a canvas for utopian experiments. Amanda Colson Hurley is a senior editor at CityLab. She's just out with the book Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we opened the introduction with that Malvina Reynolds song because you opened the book with it. She was describing a kind of platonic ideal of an exclusionary white suburb a la Levittown. But you point out that's not actually what Daly City was.
No, it wasn't. I think the initial group of residents when Daly City was built, Reynolds kind of imagined them to be, you know, upper middle class, kind of stuffy people, doctors and lawyers. I think she actually says that in the song. But they weren't. They were more kind of lower middle class people, not quite as comfortable as she had assumed. And then, you know, within a few generations, actually, Daly City became a real hub of the Filipino community. A lot of immigrants settled there and raised families there, became this sort of Filipino capital. From the beginning, I think her pretty stereotypical conception of Daly City as a place was not quite right. And nevertheless, that song has become pretty definitive, I think, for, you know, our kind of ideas of suburbia, but it was sort of rooted in some misconceptions.
We think of the suburbs as this artifact of post-World War II housing policy in the United States. But one of the earliest points you make in the book is that the history goes back much further than that. When would you say we have the first records of suburbs?
Suburbs really have been around ever since cities have been around. Archaeologists found there were suburbs outside of Ur in, I think, about 3000 BCE. So that was quite a long time ago. Ancient Rome had quite a large kind of suburban zone around the center of the city. That's actually where we get the word suburb from, the Latin suburbium. And, you know, a lot of medieval cities as well had suburbs. There's something about images of walled cities that makes it very easy to assume that the wall was kind of a hard boundary, that the city stopped at the wall. But that was not true, and that there was kind of some spillover outside the walls, and often kind of more transient people, sometimes marginalized people, would live outside of the city walls. It was a little less secure, a little less protected. But certainly, you know, cities have had suburbs throughout history. And although the United States saw a really big boom in suburban development and living after the Second World War, this country has also had suburbs for a long time, since certainly before the Revolutionary War. And then before European colonization, a lot of indigenous cities had their own suburban zones around them, archaeologists are finding, which is pretty interesting.
Suburbs is a location for the poor and working class is more the norm than the exception through history.
Yeah, I'd say suburbs have always been a real, have often been a real mix. Like outside of ancient Rome, there were kind of suburban type areas where wealthy people might have kind of weekend country houses, kind of estates. That was certainly true in a lot of suburban places. But also, at the same time, you know, suburbs were where cities, you know, often pushed kind of industry industries that nobody wanted to live nearby. Things like tanning, kind of, you know, noxious, smelly and unpleasant type of activities got pushed to the outskirts of the city. People didn't want to live around it. And, other industrial uses, too. So a lot of the times the suburbs were just kind of a hodgepodge.
You've built the book around case studies and kind of utopian experiments in the American suburban zone. And I was hoping you could take us through two of them in particular. The first is created by a group of anarchists fleeing New York City for Central Jersey.
Right. That might be my favorite case study in the book, actually. Yeah, so in the 1910s, there was this association of kind of anarchist-leaning people in New York City, and they had a kind of center in Manhattan where they would hold classes, have evening lectures, meetings, things like that. And I think it was in the mid-1910s, there were a few anarchists in the city who had actually been planning, they had been building a bomb, and it's not entirely clear what they intended to do with that bomb, but it blew up while they were working on it, and it killed them. And the police figured out that they had some links to this center. So the people who belonged to the center, who included a lot of nonviolent people, you know, interested in anarchist ideas, the members of the center found themselves under pretty intense scrutiny. And at the same time, they were also very interested in sort of progressive education for children and had started a fledgling little progressive school. And so, you know, because they wanted to sort of get away from this police crackdown, and they also wanted to find, well, you know, a healthy environment to teach children, they decided to head out to New Jersey, kind of consummate suburbanite, consummate suburban location, right? And they bought some land in central New Jersey in what is now Piscataway, not far from New Brunswick, and, you know, a bunch of them moved out there. I think initially it was, you know, a few dozen, and then it grew to a few hundred people before long.
So, like, what were the organizing principles for the community they grew?
Well, I mean, it was pretty radically democratic. Unlike some of the other communities that I studied, there wasn't really like one clear founder or leader. They had community meetings where people voted on issues. They did have committees that formed to kind of handle different elements of community life. It was, you know, they were anarchists. It was a pretty do what you want type of atmosphere within limits. Yeah, and it was also before zoning became the law of the land. So that's kind of interesting because people bought 1-acre lots from the association. The association bought a larger parcel of land. And really, they just sort of built their own houses a lot of the time, and they were quite modest. You know, a lot of people had no experience in construction. And so they really looked like today's tiny houses often when you look at photos of them. You know, just 2 or 3 rooms, very basic. They built these little cottages, and sometimes if they had family, you know, who wanted to come join them, they would build another one on their land. And there weren't, you know, a lot of regulations to stop them from doing that. People kept chickens, they kept cows. So there was still some kind of agricultural uses of the land going on, even as they were suburbanizing it and as the kind of areas around them were suburbanizing. So it was a pretty kind of motley, fascinating little place.
So I thought this is such an interesting example because for a lot of these utopian experiments, the philosophy about what an ideal society is informs the built environment. But in this case, it's anarchists, so the built form is just kind of a free-for-all.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it is interesting, and it is a pretty stark contrast. You know, the whole idea of settling this community was that the architecture and kind of urban plan would really embody their social ideals, and this was really not the case. It was very kind of improvised. You know, they went out there without a lot of planning. I don't think there was an architect or a kind of urban planner in their number. Part of that is a sort of, I think, a social class difference. Unlike a lot of the sort of utopian experimenters of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a lot of them were working class, quite recent immigrants from Eastern Europe. You know, most of them were, you know, Jewish immigrants who worked in the garment district. Some of them had somewhat romantic ideas about kind of going back to the land. I guess a physical embodiment of their of their anarchist ideals was just kind of never the point. The focus was also much more on the school. They really, with the school, they hoped that they could raise a generation of children who, you know, would be real free thinkers. And that was really their hope.
So there's kind of already this long-established tradition in America of people trying to establish utopian societies, but like way out in the countryside in upstate New York or, you know, out near the Western frontier. Why did they land in the suburbs? When they were leaving New York City, why didn't they get further than Central Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, you do wonder why wouldn't they go strike out for a, you know, a farther destination, and wouldn't that give them the independence and the privacy they wanted? I think, though, for them and for some of the other groups that I write about, the suburbs were this sort of perfect compromise location. And I find that so funny because I think for a lot of people who live in suburbia now, that's kind of how they look at it, too. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who never really set out to live in the suburbs, right? Oh, my dream is to live in the suburbs. I think a lot of people would, you know, just try to balance, well, I, you know, want a house of this size at this price, and I want to be not too much, too far from my job. And, you know, there might be other, you know, types of things they're looking for, but suburbia ends up being the kind of compromise solution, right? And I think it was the same thing for the anarchists who lived at the Stelton Colony, in that it had a great location in some ways because it was right on the Pennsylvania Railroad. So they could get back to work. As I said before, they were, you know, they were working class people. They weren't kind of affluent people kind of playing at utopia with some money they inherited or anything like that. They still needed a source of income. And so a lot of them continued to commute back to New York. It was a long train ride. They had to catch a very early morning train, but they did it. And then other people didn't commute every day, but they would maybe go into the city a couple of times a week, say, you know, for people actually who were chicken farmers, they might collect their eggs and actually just take a crate of eggs into the city and sell them there and then come back. Being close to the city really enabled them to survive. And it was also convenient for the school. They were running the school, and some of the students were, you know, were boarders. Their parents did not live in the colony. And so it was very convenient that, you know, the parents could send their children on the train. It wasn't that far. Then the parents could come visit. So I think, you know, having that connection back to the city was really vital for them. And I don't think the community would have survived for a number of decades if that had not been the case.
How long did it kind of retain its integrity as a utopian anarchist community?
It was never exclusively anarchist. There were also socialists, communists, and there was always quite a lot of friction, and that would spike at certain times. For instance, you know, after the Russian Revolution, there was a lot of debate over whether this was, you know, the real revolution or not. You know, over the years, you know, it kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of the population, but it did remain a community, I'd say, right up until around the Second World War. Actually, the kind of, you know, one of the things that precipitated its demise was a big U.S. Army camp opening up right next door. People in the community felt suddenly that they had kind of left New York City to get away from the authorities, and suddenly the authorities were right in their backyard again, you know, thousands of soldiers. So they didn't like that. I think also anarchism was just kind of, you know, had kind of declined as a, you know, as a political philosophy. You know, its popularity had decreased, and so people were less attracted to that. So people just kind of trickled away, I'd say, through the 40s, and the school closed, I think, in the early 50s. So by that time, it really wasn't a colony anymore, although a few residents did, I think, remain in that area right up through the 1970s.
You also point out that the community itself, because of its politics, let black people in?
Yes, that's kind of a fascinating sort of coda to the story of the Stelton Colony, is that after the Second World War, veterans were returning home, and suddenly the suburban post-war housing boom had kind of kicked into gear, and new suburban developments were going up, certainly in that part of New Jersey. But Black veterans were excluded from most of them because, a lot of home builders at that time, would not sell to African Americans. It was before the Fair Housing Act. So, a lot of the suburbs going up were exclusively white. But because the Stilton Colony, it was already there, and there had been a certain degree of, I think, racial and certainly ethnic diversity baked into it from the start. But, the residents didn't have any problem selling their homes to African Americans, and so they did just that. And so that, the area did grow an African American community after that. And I think early on, interestingly, I think that attracted the attention of the FBI. They were very worried that, great, first we had anarchists here, and now we have anarchists and a Black community. That was seen as a potential source of, unrest.
What did the FBI do about it?
From what I can tell, nothing except sort of, interview some people and I guess internally express concern about this. But I don't, as far as I know, nothing came of it. Residents did say, at least one resident reported an FBI agent, I think, coming to her door and kind of asking about, why are there these new Black people moving into the neighborhood? And, I don't know if there was any official action or investigation.
So I want to move on to like an interesting counterpoint utopian community that you profile in the next chapter in the book. This is Greenbelt, Maryland. It is a government-conceived utopia. Can you tell us its backstory?
Sure. Yeah. Well, Greenbelt was and is a fascinating place. During the Depression, planners who, going all the way up to FDR's inner circle, were quite taken with the idea of kind of modernist urban planning that they saw in happening in Europe, especially, and with the idea of kind of satellite cities. And, they were quite vexed by the overcrowding they saw in a lot of inner city areas, and thought that the kind of solution to it was to push people out, especially lower income people who could not afford at that time often anything more than a kind of cramped little apartment, to give them more space in, a sort of master planned satellite suburb outside of the city where they would be able to rent a more comfortable home. It was sort of really the kind of philosophy behind European social housing, which is public housing, but it's really known as kind of social housing, reflecting this kind of more egalitarian approach to it. During the New Deal, there was, money, there was money available. And, government planners really wanted to build demonstration towns that use some of those same European, modernist planning and architectural principles and apply them in the United States. And originally they wanted to build, 25 of them. They thought that, every city should have one of these, but that quickly got whittled down to 3. And Greenbelt is probably the sort of best developed example. And it's really different to the suburbs that were built after the Second World War, but also to the suburbs that had been built, in the 1920s and before. It was mainly composed of kind of mid-rise apartment buildings and townhouse rows. And the townhouses were quite small, but they were built to be very efficient. They had modern appliances and they were built with kind of smart planning principles so that, a family of 4 or 5 could fit into it without feeling too squeezed. And they were built around, the dwellings were built around these kind of green courtyards. Instead of everybody having, a fenced in backyard, the idea was that you shared this green space with your neighbors and that this would sort of foster social cohesion and a sense of community. People would get to know their neighbors. So it was really very different to, you know, the standard U.S. suburb, and perhaps in no way more than the fact that people were renting these homes from the United States government. And so, you know, it was public housing, considering how many suburbs have tried to block or chase away public housing as something that, you know, is viewed as inherently negative. It really is quite striking that this was very carefully planned and quite dignified, you know, a public housing that's still quite a lovely place to walk around and visit.
So how did, like, public housing devolve from New Deal era utopian communities that housed people of varied income strata to the kind of, you know, brick towers characteristic of the 1960s that developed horrible reputations for being centers of concentrated poverty and crime?
Well, I'm sure there's a long account to be told there, and I'm not really an expert on the history of public housing. But I think, you know, the short version is that, you know, from the beginning, real estate and home building industries were really strongly opposed to this federal town building plan. They didn't like the idea with Greenbelt. You know, they saw the government as you know, competing with them, and so there was a lot of very strong opposition to Greenbelt and generally to the sort of, you know, to the advocacy that and the advocates who wanted to spread the Greenbelt model, you know, around the country. That kind of ended up winning out. Federal, you know, there was never a great amount of money allocated to public housing, and there were policy decisions that really reserved it for really very low income people, you know, for the most part. So I think that's kind of what happened. But certainly, you know, in the 30s and before, there were people in the United States who advocated, you know, quite strongly for subsidized housing that would be for people of modest means, but not necessarily people living in poverty. And in fact, in Greenbelt, you know, the families, there was an income cap. You know, you couldn't live there if you were kind of affluent, but they really, the people who lived there were not the working poor. I mean, they were often, they were people on kind of modest professional or kind of blue collar salaries, but it was really for kind of the established working class or the lower middle class, maybe would be the way to describe it.
So it's interesting because, you know, there's a question you return to periodically in the book, which is basically, does the built environment make the person or does the person make the built environment? And this is not the case of an ideologically homogenous group of people who go out to craft their vision in the suburbs. This was a government project, and the people came along after the vision was already realized. But by the time the government was divesting itself of the homes, they had cohered enough as a community to form a cooperative ownership structure. That seems like a powerful argument for the built environment engendering a certain type of politics, doesn't it?
That's a great point. I think, I mean, I would say there was a little bit of selection bias, you know, because I think when they chose the residents initially, I mean, there was a tenant selection committee. And because this was a demonstration project, you know, the government was concerned about the optics. And so they were pretty careful in who they selected. If they met a family and thought that, yeah, they're not really joiners, or, you know, they seem too shy or too combative or something, they, you know, they might not be picked. So I think there was a little selection bias in terms of people who were joiners and just liked, you know, the whole idea of the town and what it stood for. They were probably a little more likely to be selected. But you're right that there was a range of certainly kind of religions, ethnic backgrounds, and you know, and jobs and regional backgrounds among the residents, and yet there was definitely a sense of a cohesive sense of identity that lingered. And I think, you know, the answer that I came to, which is maybe not that satisfying, is that it's sort of a little bit of both, right? I mean, I think that, you know, I think it's kind of too deterministic to say that if you grow up in a certain type of environment, you know, you're just going to be a mere product of that environment, molded by it with kind of no agency. I don't think that the environment plays that big a role in shaping who we are. But, you know, there do seem to be values that are kind of imparted, you know, over the long term by these environments that that people do appreciate. And people told me time and again when I interviewed them how much it meant to them to live in these places or to be from these places and how they felt that it had shaped them. So I think that, you know, you can't dismiss the power of the environment around us.
Well, it's a lovely book, Amanda Colson Hurley. Thank you so much for the book, and thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Amanda Colson Hurley is a senior editor at CityLab. Her new book is Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City.
And that takes us to almost 8:01 in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world at www.kpfa.org. The show is Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeker. Coming up, after news headlines, we're going to try to dissect the procedural punt the Supreme Court just did on one of the major gerrymandering cases facing it. They have decided that in the appeal of a lower court ruling forcing redistricting in the state of Virginia, that the Virginia House of Delegates, the entity appealing that decision, didn't actually have standing to go to court. What that augurs for the hopes of getting some kind of rational standard for determining which gerrymanders are illegal in the future, nobody really knows, but we'll talk to someone who knows more than me. That's coming up next after the news.